There's nothing different about me. I'm just another bored male approaching 30 in a dead-end job who lives for the weekend. Casual sex, watered-down lager, heavily cut drugs. And occasionally, kicking fuck out of somebody. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today, I would like to talk about English football hooligans and the rise of English football hooligans and the causes of the view, anyway, that England should be associated with football hooligans. Now, I didn't really realise just how intense this view was, that English people are football hooligans, till I was about 23, and I was postgraduate at the University of Leiden, and me and a group of friends went on a little trip to the north of Holland. We might have been staying in Groningen. And I said to my friend, our group of five or six, whatever it was, in the dorm, and then there was two Belgian young chaps, and I said to my French friend, who they didn't know was French, I said, "Oh, are we going to go out and get drunk tonight then?" And they apparently made some comment about that. They, "Oh my God, we're staying in with an English person who's going to get drunk in this dorm. It could get violent. Should we look into staying somewhere else?" And this was seriously meant. And my French friend overheard this and said to them, "No, he's only joking. Don't worry." And he said to me later, I said, "Cedric, why did they react like that then? Why were they scared that I was going to get drunk?" He said, "Oh, well, you have this reputation abroad. You English, you know, the football hooligan. And that's what they think about you. So if you're English and you say you're going to get drunk," I couldn't believe it. But before we go into it further, a word from our sponsor. Before we start, I'd just like to say a word about our sponsor, and that is Atlas VPN. Now, here's the situation, chaps. We are all truth seekers here at the Jolly Heretic Public House. We all want to know the truth about the world, and the only way we can do that is if we get lots of different perspectives, lots of alternative perspectives. And we are in a situation where we cannot get that. The internet is censored, everything is censored, and we literally cannot get the other side with regard to certain important events that are happening in the world because of the way that they censor the internet. So the only thing to do, as far as I'm concerned, is to use a VPN. And Atlas VPN is currently running a huge discount. It means you can get a 3-month subscription for just $1.83 a month, plus 3 months for free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And so time is running out, so it's worth looking into, really. There's lots and lots of benefits to this. Not only is that you've got that deal, but you could unlock your favourite content from all over the world. You know, shows from friends or whatever it is you like are using Atlas VPN. You can keep your Google searches private. They make sure that your results aren't tracked and so forth. You can stop ads and malware. It's more than just a VPN. It blocks malicious links and ads and so forth. And it notifies you when someone's trying to steal your data. And you can save money online. It notifies you of the best deals. And it can protect unlimited devices. So it seems to be a jolly good idea. And as I say, they've currently got this campaign where it's just $1.83 a month. So, you know, it's worth thinking about. $1.83 a month for a 3-year subscription, plus 3 months for free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Time is running out, so, you know, it's certainly worth looking into. So as a person that is in favour of the truth and wants as much as many different perspectives as possible and is finding these blocked by our current system, I think getting a VPN is worth doing. And as far as I can see, Atlas VPN is where it's at, chaps. Okay, I've changed my shirt back and off we go. So let's look then at how this idea that the English are football hooligans. There seems to be an idea that uniquely the English are prone towards football hooliganism. How has this happened? Well, it's basically a myth. And that's what I want to explore today. I want to explore how that myth has developed. There have always been gangs of young thugs in England and indeed in most other countries. If you go back to medieval England or you go back to sources on Tudor England or whatever, there is always concern about young men dividing up into groups based on what village they live in or what part of the town they live in or whatever, and fighting. This development of young men into gangs has always been the case. And it could be argued that is exactly how we are evolved. Males are evolved to create to basically be soldiers, to create an army, to create a group that then battles another group in order to attain that group's territory. And they are then evolved to play for status, to attempt to gain the highest status possible within that group, because it is the females will sexually select for the males that have the highest status within that group. And the males that have the highest status within that group, they will then dominate the gene pool. The females will disproportionately want to have sex with them, because the fact that they have attained that high status in the group implies they have good genes in whatever environment they're in, and therefore the female's offspring will be more likely to survive. Also, if the males have more status, they will have more access to resources. They will be able to invest these in the female and their offspring, and so the female and their offspring will be more likely to survive. So for these reasons, males are prone to divide into complex gangs and to try to reach the top of those gangs. With females, it's a bit different. There is evidence from evolutionary psychology that females, because they are sexually attracted to status for obvious evolutionary reasons, they will all want to circle around the highest status male, and therefore you end up with a harem. Once you end up with a harem, then of course the females are competing for the attention, for the resources, whatever, of the high status male. The high status male will tend to focus most of his resources on the newest and most nubile wife at any given time, and less on the other wives. The co-wives will therefore help to alloparent each other's children. So female friendships are very different from male friendships. They tend to involve a small number of very close friends that are exclusive friends who are potential alloparents for your children. So the whole psychology of friendship is different. So there's a high level of investment involved, because there's a high level of bonding involved, because you're looking after children and so on, it's a small number of them that you really, really have to be able to trust. And so therefore you have to be strongly bonded with them. And so this militates in favour of very close one-to-one friendships, in which females will share information and personal concerns and whatever, but they are one to one, and they're a small number of them, and then anyone else that is not one of your alloparents is actually a potential enemy, because they are competing with you for your friends, for high status alloparents, and so this militates in favour of the development of cliques. Now with Met, that's completely understandable that these female friendships are a bit different, much closer, much more intense, much more one on one. With men, that's not the case. They are evolved to be part of these gangs, and indeed to be part of violent gangs. And it's been argued this is particularly the case among young men, because that is the exact age in prehistory in which you'd be fighting for status to try and get females. It's the exact age in which your group would be fighting other groups in order to control the most territory to hunt in. It's the exact age that kind of violence would take place. So it makes a great deal of sense that there will always be these gangs, that males will always fall into some kind of gang. And if they are in an unstable kind of environment, if they are poor, if they are in a relatively dangerous sort of environment, then this will be all the more important, because the gang will afford you protection from other gangs and from other social problems. So there should be nothing amazing that young boys will tend to develop male status hierarchy gangs, and that those gangs will as a sort of an evolutionary throwback, as it were, be completely unnecessarily... We're basically in an evolutionary mismatch. We're evolved for the situation where the alternative gang is the alternative tribe, is dangerous and whatever, and so that psychology hits in, and therefore you will be violent and dangerous towards the alternative gang. Now, as I said, there's always been gang violence. There was concerns about gang violence of this kind in Tudor England. We're evolved for these gangs. When football started, it very quickly it became very, very violent, drunken games between villages. This is in medieval England, where you kicked around a pig's bladder. And of course, there would be a strong sense of local identity between these villagers. Give it a bit of alcohol, give it a bit of them being a bit genetically different, give it some poverty, and of course, very quickly, you get give it a bit of local identity, and you get these football becoming violent. And it was commented on in medieval England. This was a serious problem, the violence of football. And they wanted to kind of persuade young men to move away from football and towards practicing archery, because it was more useful for the society that all young men could successfully practice archery. Now, football only really took off in the 19th century. In England. That's when football became really, really popular. That's when, as with a lot of these sports, it was codified and it started to become more and more professional. And you had these local groups that would develop into regular football teams that would meet on Saturdays or traditionally at 3 p.m. And this again militated in favour of thuggery. So it created a new kind of locus of identity, which is very interesting. So you have, by the 19th century, a lot of movement, a lot of people moving from village to village, moving from area to area in search of work and so on. And so there's an extent to which the football team of your area started to create a kind of locus of identity, if you like. You know, this is the football team, Tottenham Hotspur. We are from, there's no clear area really that was Tottenham by then. It had all merged into other areas and whatever. But so, you know, we are from around this football patch, this football team. And so it creates a locus of identity, and identity making sense of the world, knowing where you are in the world. In a changing world like Victorian England, in which there's lots of movement, lots of people moving in from the countryside and all this kind of thing, is very important. So you start to get a sense of identity developing, not just around the part of London that you happen to come from or the pub you happen to drink at. I mean, that people would sing songs about, they would drink at the Lavender Inn. They'd say, oh, we are the Lavender Boys or whatever. In much the same way, or that we are from a certain part of Winchester called Winnell. We are the Winnell Boys. There was this sense of identity that would be developed around this area, and you would also get the development of a sense of identity based around your local football team. And this would be expressed in songs, in tattoos, in dressing in a certain way and whatever. This all has its seeds back in the 19th century. Now, even then, there were concerns about thugs at football matches. Even in the 19th century, there were reports about gangs of roughs. They would get drunk because, of course, the matches didn't start till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And in those days, pubs opened at about 6 in the morning. So they could drink all day. By the time they turned up at the pub, they couldn't. It would be half holiday in those days, but they could drink any from midday anyway till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then they'd be well up for a ruck. And so you would get these spontaneous fights between the supporters of different football teams who would be drunk, who would have this strong sense of local identity, who would be young, who would have this sense of gang warfare and whatever. And so it may seem irrational, but it's, as I said, it's an evolution. Throwback. It's an evolutionary mismatch that you have this psychology to some extent where we are evolved to be hunter-gatherers. That's most of our history thrown into the modern day. And so you can see how riot throwing of bottles, whatever, would break out at football matches. Now, by the 20th century, it's from about the 1950s or 60s onwards that you start to see organised, planned football hooliganism. Now, what you've also seen across that time is the further rise of football. Football has further professionalised. Football by this stage, by the 50s, it's mostly professional. It's a constant. It's every Saturday and occasionally on weekdays without fail. And it becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger part of the lives of working class people. It becomes a bigger and bigger part of their sense of identity, of their sense of who they are. You have more and more of the development of chants, of songs, of them wearing certain clothing, such as their team kit or whatever, of them having tattoos involving their team. And so it becomes more and more and more of a new, of a de facto local identity for them. They have a local identity, and this is of where they're from. Let's say they're from West Ham or Wimbledon. And then this is all wrapped up in the fact that there are champions, if you like. There are champions of Wimbledon. And this is the Wimbledon team. And that team represents your area, Wimbledon, where you're from, which you find home, in a country that's still regionalised and in which there are significant regional differences in dialect and culture and whatever, in which there is still a sense of regional rivalry against some other team. And at the same time, you have this desire to fight, you have this desire to be part of a gang, you have this desire to commit violence and whatever, and it all comes together in the form of football hooliganism. And so you have more and more and more of this kind of, as the identity, the football related identity gets stronger. There is more easily available alcohol. You can take alcohol into the ground and that sort of thing. And then also, I suppose, the other element to it is the general factor that was occurring after the war, which was just the rise of youth culture. So people forget that before the war, there was really no such thing as teenagers. there was no such thing, not in a clear way that we have it now, of the sort of youthful rebellion. Teenagers just dressed like children, teenagers just dressed like everybody else dressed. They were just mini adults. And you had this development after the war of a rebellion. I mean, we can speculate on the causes of this rebellion, but of a rebellion against traditional nodes of authority. And this could be seen in the form of, you know, in the 50s of Teddy Boys and people like this, then later mods and rockers, of these youth gangs based around a certain kind of identity that would develop and would just sort of rebel and cause trouble. Now, I should say that you had that before, in the 16th century even, you had these gangs, but it was interesting that the extent to which they were countercultural, the extent to which they dressed differently, the extent to which they didn't conform to the norms of society. And so you had then a general moral panic about basically youth and thuggery that you'd had in the 19th century, but it was more extreme now, it was more pronounced, and there was more evidence of them behaving in criminal ways and so on. So you had this general moral panic. Now, I've looked before, there's all kinds of reasons for this. I don't know, the wake of a massive war, I mean, the trauma caused by it. There's all kinds of reasons we could speculate on. I personally think that a reasonable explanation that would explain everything is the break, you're not going to be surprised to hear this, is the breakdown of Darwinian selection for green group oriented, which eventually leads to a tipping point where such a high percentage of people are individually oriented and basically selfish that the society sort of breaks down and tips over towards being individualistic. And then it becomes easier and easier because the group oriented structures are breaking down. Because people are flipping over to accepting individualism, it becomes easier and easier to rebel. It becomes easier and easier to it becomes almost a good thing to rebel. It becomes something encouraged. It becomes a sign that you're a morally good person, that you're rebelling against the system. We now laud the generation of rebels in the 1960s and are now in power. Are now the establishment, and it is a rebellion in many ways to hold to the views that were popular in the 90s, that were dominant in the 1950s. So I think it's a part of this. It's a part of a general breakdown, a general melee, the kind of post-1963, you know, Philip Larkin, Sex came rather late for me in 1963, somewhere between the end of the Chappelle Band and the Beatles' first LP. It's a sign of this general breakdown that people are prepared to engage in yobbish, thuggish behaviour to this extent that they're prepared to be so antisocial. So I think that was kind of what was going on. I think that's what it was part of, and that for that reason, then it was emphasised by the newspapers. There was a general moral panic in England in the 60s about youth rebellion and whatever, and so when this football hooliganism started to come to light, you start to see the newspapers really exaggerating it, really playing it up, really reporting on it. Now this then creates this kind of social contagion effect, right, where other football wannabe hooligans think to themselves, oh, you know, I'll do that. It's being reported about on the television all the time. It's being reported about in the newspapers all the time. We'll do that. And so you get more and more of this football hooliganism. Now, in general, it's organic. The people that have done research into this have found, I thought to myself, I wondered if it was something to do with technology, if it was something to do with the rise of the telephone, that people could ring each other up and plan things and whatever. But no, it started off as just people being drunk and throwing things and having fights at grounds. And then gradually and organically, it became much more organised. The people would meet at pubs and it was, you know, someone knows someone and someone knows someone. And my enemy's enemy is my enemy. My friend's friend is my friend. That kind of attitude. And sorry to blow my nose. And I know you moan about this. And so it became more and more organised. And then eventually you have the idea that they had to start separating the two football supporters, which they do, so that the intense supporters of the home team stand behind this goal and the intense supporters of the away team stand behind this goal. And then you had the different ends named after, you know, the Leppings Lane end, whatever. And then you have the idea, let's try and storm the other end. Let's try and get into a fight in the football ground itself. Let's try and invade the pitch. And also let's organise fights, basically, to occur before or after the match. And so this goes on and on and on, and it gets reported more and more and more. It's happening in other countries as well, by the way. It's not just happening in England. It's happening in other countries as well. It's being reported in other countries as well. It's being France, whatever. It's not Holland. It's not United unique to England. But what starts to make it, the English newspapers do make a big song and dance out of it, which I think probably helps to exaggerate it, which helps to make people think it was more prevalent than it was. At the average football match, you probably wouldn't have a problem, and helps people and makes people think that it's a particularly English disease, English problem. It became established as an English problem in the 1980s. In 1985, in particular, there was a match between Liverpool and Juventus, and the Juventus fans and the Liverpool fans started fighting each other and throwing things at each other and all this sort of thing. And eventually a Juventus fan fired a gun. It turned out to be a starter pistol, but it was believed to be a gun, with the result that the Liverpool fans stormed the Juventus fans, and with the result that a wall collapsed, with the result that 39 people were killed, 38 Italians and one Belgian. And that was really then, that was a huge international news. And that and the English was a European Cup match. And so then the English football team was banned for, I think, was it 5 years, from participating in European matches. And so then it was then it just became cemented that, oh yeah, this was English football hooliganism. It's an English thing. It's the English disease. And they started taking action against it, which was utterly counterproductive. In 1986, there was a case of a particular ferry, the Koningin Beatrix or something, that was going from England to Holland because there were pre-season friendlies. For some reason, we weren't banned from these. Pre-season friendlies between West Ham and some Dutch team and between Manchester United and some Dutch team. On the boat, there have been rivalries between Manchester United and West Ham. And so the result was, on the boat itself, there was a massive fight between the Manchester United fans and the West Ham fans. Of course, you could imagine what it's like on a boat with all of these layers and things. It was swishing with blood. And the captain had to put out an emergency mayday, and some other boat had to come along and remove these football hooligans from his boat so that he could continue with his voyage. Like, that's how bad it got. Now, the newspapers in Britain, of course, went on and on about this. They would publish articles about different football hooligan firms from different teams, who were the hardest, who got into the most fights. So that although they were condemning it, they were in a sense tacitly encouraging it. They were appealing to the English and to the working class sense of, you know, competition and being the hardest and being the best man and saying who's got the hardest firm, who's got the yobbiest firm. And so this just makes it, on the one hand, they're condemning it, but on the other hand, they're kind of praising it. And so therefore, it just spreads even further. And so you get this moral panic about football hooliganism, and this which is actually exaggerated out of all proportion, which then spreads internationally as well. And so there is this strong belief. I think there's a person that asked me to do this show, Mr. Pink, who sponsored this show. Thank you very much, sir. And he obviously seems to, he's a foreigner, he's not English. He seems to be of the view that it's a uniquely English thing, but it isn't. The level of violence, if it was higher in England, it was only because of the moral panic that broke out in England, which resulted in the newspapers kind of in a way encouraging it, which resulted in it spreading further. I don't think it says anything. It's nothing about, you know, unique to the nature of the English. We're not uniquely Wellard. Well, we are uniquely Wellard, obviously, but that's not reflected necessarily in the football hooliganism. Now, the result of this was, of course, a massive campaign to clamp down on football hooliganism, and in particular, the stop pitch invasions. So I remember when was it? 1990, I think it might have been, or 91, going to a football match, Wimbledon v Arsenal. And I couldn't believe it. Normally, it had all been very, very pleasant and whatever. I'd been to a number of matches. It was all very pleasant. This match, the Arsenal fans were nasty. Separated from where we were sitting, on the other side of a sort of a wire fence, Arsenal fans, they were shouting things like, fucking Fashanu, Wimbledon, get out of the league, and all this. And whenever the Fashanu, who was black, came on, they'd do monkey impressions and things like this. Yeah, they were very, very unpleasant. But anyway, I think it was 1989 or 88, I forget which, I think 89, there was the Hillsborough disaster, which was a direct, indirect result of football hooliganism. What they had done is they put up these fences at the front of where you stand, because a lot of the stadiums you'd stand up, to stop the fans getting onto the pitch. That was the point of it. So you had these high fences to make it absolutely impossible for the fans to get onto the pitch. Now, for various reasons of police incompetence and whatever, there was a crush at this particular match, with the result that a lot of people were killed. I think it was about 80 people or more, was it? 90 people was crushed to death at the Hillsborough disaster. And that was because of football hooliganism, in the sense that those fences were there because of football hooliganism. And the stress the police were under, which may have made them make bad decisions and whatever, was because of the possibility of football hooliganism. So football hooliganism kind of led to that. And then after that, you had the introduction of all-seater stadiums, which made this more difficult. You had the introduction of greater security. You start to get CCTV cameras, and you get this massive clampdown on football hooliganism. And also football's matches have become much more expensive, which kind of stops ordinary working class people from going to them. Most people that go to these matches now have season tickets, which are very expensive. If you want to go to the away matches, you've got to have, realistically, you know, you've got to have a season ticket, and they will withdraw your season ticket if there's any kind of violence and whatever. And so football hooliganism has been stamped out. And one could argue that the fact that it's been stamped out shows you that it's probably some matter of cultural contagion in part, rather than something deep in the English psyche. So I hope that helps us to understand then the nature of football hooliganism. It is not something profound to Englishness. It is a result of an evolutionary mismatch where we are evolved to live in a hunter-gatherer society. We are plunged into this evolutionary mismatch, and therefore we naturally have the same psychology. We develop gangs. We develop gangs based around certain loci. Football was that loci, and then, as because of a combination of a general breakdown in society that happened in the 60s, plus the media and social contagion, we have that stereotype. So there you go.
Hello, hello, hello! The Jolly Heretic is an online public house which meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss the kind of based, fearless science which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you would like to help the Jolly Heretic public house, and there are many ways you can do so, please, please, please become one of my patrons on Subscribestar. Also, if you want to, you can donate to the channel using Odyssey and Entropy, and you can also purchase Jolly Heretic merchandise, such as shirts and mugs. All of the links are in the description. Again, I'd be most violently grateful if you could assist the Jolly Heretic Public House, and I will see you all soon, and goodbye!